Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Stuart H. Altman, who is the Sol C. Shaken Professor of National Health Policy at the Florence Heller Graduate School for Social Policy at Brandeis University. He is the author, with David Shachman, of Power, Politics, and Universal Healthcare. Dr. Altman, welcome to Berkeley.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, my parents were Depression parents. They were not worldly in the classic sense. Neither of them went to college. My father actually got a job when he was 18 years old and stayed with the same company. My brother and I are both professors, and so you might look at our parents and say, well, to what extent did it come from your parents? At one level, the answer would be no, but the real answer was that they instilled in us self-confidence, a sense that we could do whatever we wanted.
Mm-hmm. As proves to be the case in your book, which we'll get to in a minute. And was there discussion of politics or domestic politics?
Not really.
Not really.
You know, people find it hard that I've been so involved in the whole political system in America for the last 40 years. But I really was not at a young age involved. I was, you know, more concerned on who was going to win the pennant and girls. Mm-hmm. Why I couldn't make the baseball team and that kind of stuff. So I didn't grow up in an environment that was very politically astute or that much involved in politics.
And where did you do your undergraduate work?
So I did my undergraduate work in downtown New York, City College. I originally was thinking of going into the investment world because I had started working as a young 16-year-old at a company that was part of Wall Street. And then I came under the tutelage of a young, energetic economist who convinced me that to think more broadly about economics. And I finished my undergraduate degree at City College and then came out here. Actually, I'm a UCLA mm-hmm. PhD.
In economics?
In economics.
And what was your dissertation on?
My dissertation was on unemployed married women. Mm-hmm. I want to give myself a little credit. This was the early 1960s, and I went to a very conservative economics department that believed that we shouldn't worry about the unemployed, and particularly women in the labor force, that they really weren't interested in full-time jobs. And I actually wrote a dissertation and said they were wrong and that women were here to stay, and that they were going to become a major component of our labor force. I almost didn't get my degree because I had a fight with my faculty advisors, but I told them that I knew more than they did when it came to this. And so anyway, my dissertation was on unemployed married women, nothing to do with healthcare at the time.
I like to ask my guests what they see as the skills and temperament required for the work that they have done. In your case, you've worked at the intersection of ideas and being active in policy realms. So what are the skills that you think are really relevant, especially when you're talking about the field of healthcare reform and the economics of healthcare reform?
Well, you know, it's hard to be introspective completely, but I think my success, to the extent that I've been successful, and I think I have, is that I combine a reasonably sharp mind about analyzing events with the ability to translate it into fairly simple and convincing arguments for policymakers. So at a young age, and I wound up, and then I was, as I said, lucky, and I wouldn't discount that, but I was in the, I actually went from worrying about women in the to being in the Pentagon and worrying and doing working for McNamara, and was involved in the creation of an all-volunteer military. And the senior people in the Pentagon liked me and liked what I had to say, and I became close to them. And then one of them moved on from the Pentagon to what was then HEW, Health, Education, and Welfare. And he became the principal analyst during the Johnson administration.
And this was, who was that?
So his name is Bill Gorham. Mm. And he went, this was in 1966, as the Vietnam War was heating up. And I, and many of the people that I work with in the Pentagon went with him, but I decided I wanted to be an academic, and so I went to teach at Brown in the economics department. And while I was there, my friends who were then at HEW said, we have a problem with what to do with nurses and whether how we should train more of them. And they said, you know all about women in the labor force. Tell us what
so luck at work.
There you go. Yeah. I tell you. And I came down to Washington, and being a good academic, I told them this was more complicated and I needed a grant to work on it. And I wrote my first major policy book on the future supply of registered nurses.
Mm-hmm. And there must be, I'm curious about this temperament question, because especially in the healthcare field, there's a lot of frustration in terms of knowing what you know and seeing what the ideal policy is, but then living with the frustration of no implementation.
Well, let me tell you, I've thought about that a lot. You really have to enjoy the game. Mm-hmm. You cannot go into the policy environment for big issues like healthcare and healthcare reform and totally say that if it doesn't succeed the way I want it, I'm a failure, I can't live with it, be frustrated. You really have to enjoy the process. And I do. I enjoy the process. Obviously, I enjoy winning. And the things that I have done occasionally have been translated into major public policy. But a lot of what I've focused on just never made it into the... And my frustration level is not high. I don't get frustrated easily.
Do you have any thoughts about this intersection of ideas and policy? That the extent to which you can have the best idea, the most perfect equations, but when the tire hits the road,
timing. You know, it's there are a lot of good ideas out there. It's the timing of an idea, and the need for that idea to be translated into policy, and the forces that come together to make it happen. And there's no substitute for good timing. Now, you need to be a good salesman, and you need to have, let's face it, when you're dealing with major policy issues, the analyst, which I am, is not going to be the ultimate salesperson. You need to have people above you who are committed and who really can make it happen. And as I said, I've worked for five presidents. I've worked for many people who are very well known. And sometimes it really worked well, and other times we really argued hard and the whole thing fell apart.
Now, at an early point in your career, you wind up in HEW. And one of the surprises in the book is that the president who offered a comprehensive health care reform was Richard Nixon. And you were at HEW, and the baton came to you, and you wrote a big chunk of that.
Yes, I did. And people, when they read the book, are shocked at how many quote-unquote liberal policies came out of the Nixon administration. Mm-hmm. To me, it was not as much of a shock for two reasons. You have to put it in the context of the time. This country had recently passed Medicare and Medicaid in the middle 1960s. There was serious talk that we were going to go to a single payer system and that the government was going to be responsible for everybody's health care. Richard Nixon, who was far from a liberal, realized that he needed to have a serious alternative that would help millions of Americans, but that wasn't a single payer approach to combat it, or that the country was going to go down the in a different way. So he instructed first my original boss at HEW, Elliot Richardson, and then Caspar Weinberger, to put together a serious, comprehensive plan. And they instructed me and my staff to do it. And to me, it seemed pretty logical, and I didn't, as I said, I had history on my side of what had happened. And looking back today, where we're so much more a conservative country, and the Republican Party in particular wouldn't even dream of even thinking along the lines of what the Nixon plan did.
And so this is an example of one of the points that you made. It was about that legislation, proposed legislation, did not succeed, and it was really about timing and luck and also the game that was being played.
Exactly. That's right. I mean, when you look back, we thought we were going to succeed. If you read the newspapers of the day, the New York Times or any of them, the question was not whether we were going to have a comprehensive health plan. It was when was it going to happen exactly and what would it look like. It was viewed by all the experts of the day in the early 1970s that we were going to pass a bill. And it came as a big shock. And it happened so suddenly. Combination of the Watergate and President Nixon resigning, and then the most powerful member of the Congress, Wilbur Mills, getting in trouble with Fannie Fox. Many people remember that, and him being embarrassed to the point of leaving the Congress, and all of the hope and all of the expectations just went poof and was gone. And, you know, people like me, which I will admit that I was just shocked, just like what happened with Bill Clinton later on. We can talk more about that. But so, yeah, I mean, all that work seemed to be for naught, but it really wasn't. It stayed in the lexicon of things. And as you read in the book, really a lot of the ideas in the Nixon plan found themselves in the Obama plan.
You are trained as an economist, but you have an astute sense, as you said, of the game and of politics. Where did that come from? Did it come over time, you know, starting out early in the Pentagon and in HEW?
I guess so. I mean, you don't really know. It wasn't a conscious decision. Being involved as much as I was in my early years after graduate school, I began to appreciate the need for compromise, how the process worked, what it took to get things done. And so I didn't write it all out and then follow the script. I just did it, and to the extent that I was successful, it was a good script.
Now, we're going to talk now about your book, but before we do that, I think we should have you state for the audience Altman's rule, and because it gives us a kind of a framework for seeing all that happens. So what is Altman's rule, and how does it apply to the healthcare debate?
Well, as I said, having been part of the debate over healthcare reform in the early 70s, and then having been part of it during the Clinton years in the 90s, and being part of it almost constantly since then, I noticed the following, and that was that most Americans, and particularly most major powerful groups within healthcare, believe that we should have universal coverage. I'm talking about the hospitals or the doctors or the, but they were very mindful of possible negative consequences of certain changes that would hurt them. So Altman's law was that every major powerful group supports healthcare reform, but if it doesn't meet their standards or meet their expectations, they would rather maintain the status quo. That's Altman's rule.
And it's what another way of saying it is they want to protect their interests
exactly.
In the game.
Yeah. Very much so. And that theoretically, they're much in support of the broader context. But, you know, it's human nature that people not only think big thoughts, but they think, how does it affect me? And you see the same thing in the individual. You know, you take the debate now with the Obama health reform. There are millions of Americans that say, well, yeah, in general, I do believe everyone should have it, but I don't like this plan. And what they're really saying, this plan is going to negatively affect me.
Mm-hmm. As one reads your book, it's a really great insights into how this healthcare reform debate is embedded in the American political culture.
Yes.
And American political history. Talk a little about that, because that is the framework that really shapes everything.
I do believe that very strongly. Being part of this debate for so long, and maybe my instincts, which are to be pragmatic and incremental, I don't believe America in its policy is a country that makes radical changes. And while everyone talks about, oh, we need to have fundamental single payer or fundamentally change the system, and why don't we do what country X or country Y does, I said, well, it's not where we are. This is too important. You're talking about an industry or a service that affects everybody, that is among, if not the largest industry in most communities, which is, you go town to town, city to city, and which is the largest employer, the hospitals, which is the most revered people, the doctors, which is the service that you're most concerned about as you get older, it's your health care. So I do believe that the whole approach that America takes in something as important as universal coverage is really incremental. And so I really I think they're just fundamentally wrong to say that the healthcare reform of Obama is a radical change in America. It is not anywhere near a radical change.
And we'll talk about the Obama plan in a minute. The other virtue of your book is kind of you walk us through the history of all of this, and it's a very interesting story and of how the obstacle to creating the perfect system comes from history, basically. And so although at the turn of the century, all of American political culture was at play to prevent any kind of universal system from occurring. It's really a key moment is during the Roosevelt administration, and it relates to not counting worker health care as a wage and not taxing businesses or giving them an exemption for essentially providing health care for their workers?
Well, yes, although if I can slightly recast that. Two things about the Roosevelt years. So here was a president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, during the 30s, which really did fundamentally change a lot of what we did before into things that are now taken for granted, like passing Social Security and redesigning government. But what was also interesting is that when he was faced with the idea of creating a government-run health insurance system or health care system, he didn't do it. So on the one side, you have the Roosevelt years of the 30s that where he stepped up to the plate and then backed away and then said, no, it's a little too complicated, so let's deal with income. And didn't even pass Medicare. I mean, he passed Social Security. Now, what you're talking about occurred during the Second World War. And I don't think it was as much a decision of the leadership of the Roosevelt as the pragmatism. And what you're saying is that during the Second World War, employers, mainly big defense contractors, wanted to help their workers, and we had wage and price controls, which meant that you couldn't raise wages. And so these employers said, well, can I give my workers a fringe benefit, a little extra, call it health care, and we won't call it a wage. And the economist then of the wage and price, I doubt it even was reviewed by the president, said, yeah, sure, you can do that. It's a little benefit. But the real codifying of that occurred in the 1950s when it was reviewed, and then it was decided that if an employer provided health care and paid for it, the amount of money that the employer paid would not be considered as part of your wage and not be part of your income tax. And as it turned out, that is a very significant amount of what we call tax policy that has allowed millions of Americans to get their health care through their job.
Mm-hmm. Now, the book walks us through a history in which, in a way, the realization of the Altman rule or the Altman rule really reflects that history. So what we get is piecemeal legislation and reform and a system in which the elderly, the poor, and kind of the disenfranchised are at the edges of the system and really aren't included except as the country enacts piecemeal legislation to include them. Hence, we get Medicare. Hence, we get the Portability Act and so on.
Well, you're right. And that's been the history of this country, not wanting to make such a gigantic leap. Children were first because there was a general positive feeling that children should have health care services. The very poor were really not part of the system in the beginning, but allowed the states and the local communities to create state-run, you know, hospitals and free care and so on. The elderly was not considered to be an important problem until our insurance system in the 1950s broke apart for them, and then it became a very hot-button political issue. But even then, it took a long time. I mean, we started talking about Medicare in the middle to late 1950s, and it wasn't until 1965-6 when all the forces came together to make it happen. And, you know, people think, well, sure, it would have happened. But, you know, when you read the book, you see how close we came to it not happening. And had we not had such a landslide legislation passed change in power to Johnson becoming president and a landslide victory on the part of the Democrats, it's very doubtful that we would have passed Medicare.
And in each time we were making an incremental step, the interests tended to be awakened, which meant you wanted to do incrementally so as not to arouse everybody against the legislation. But even you talk about the Hill-Burton Act legislation to build hospitals, especially in poorer areas, and suddenly that got involved with the whole problem of civil rights because of Southern legislators.
Yes. You know, that's a story that most people have no idea. You know, right now, if you go to the hospital and you're very sick, the hospital is required to take care of you. What most people out of this country and even in this country don't realize is we spend billions of dollars of providing free care to people that are not insured. So where did that come from? Well, it came literally through the back door. After the Second World War, our healthcare system was in shambles. We had not really built a new hospital since the 1920s, because we had the Depression and then we had the war. So our hospitals were 40, 50 years old. They were based on a style and a practice of medicine that was antiquated. Harry Truman wanted to have universal coverage, wanted to have a single-payer system. He campaigned on that. He actually won, but he didn't win in terms of the election in 46, but he didn't get that. And sort of as a much more acceptable piece of legislation that Congress passed, this so-called the Hill-Burton Law, which said that the federal government would aid local communities in building new hospitals and provide much of the funding. And the group that wanted the single payer, I don't know whether they snuck it in or how they got it in there, but there was a provision put into this law that said that if a hospital took this money, that it was obligated to provide a certain amount of care for free to people who couldn't afford it. This is 1946. There was this big issue between the South and particularly those legislators that were very nervous about having hospitals where the races would be mixed up and that a black person and a white person could be in the same hospital bed at the same time. So they were very concerned about anything, but they let this go and put in there. And really nothing happened until, it's hard to believe, but no one really enforced that provision from when it was passed in 1946 until the early 1970s. And as we talk about in the book, there was a civil rights lawyer, Marilyn Rose, who, by the way, graduated from Brandeis, who took it upon herself to mount a legal campaign to force the government to do what it was in the law. And fluke of all flukes, the Nixon administration and Elliot Richardson agreed to do it, and they asked me and my staff to decide, well, how much should a hospital contribute? And of course, what should the right number be? I mean, and we came up and did some analysis and eventually agreed upon a 3-4% of a hospital's budget could appropriately go for this. And the opposite was that if they didn't, if they turned people away, they would be violating the federal law.
The case that you provide of somebody who put aside the Altman rule was President Bill Clinton. And you argue in the book that in the first Little Rock meeting where he brought his brain trust together after he had been elected but before he assumed office, it was clear that they were going to go for the whole thing.
Yes.
And what happened at that meeting? You implicitly raised the Altman rule.
Yes, well, I did. And as a result, I got thrown out of the Clinton administration. Bill Clinton, when he ran for office, had two very different views about health care reform. He was very supportive of the need to do something. And one approach was the incremental approach, which I had been advocating, to build upon the existing system, find out what's not working, get the Tinker Toys rearranged to make the system work, but not fundamentally restructure the whole thing. And in the beginning, that's where Bill Clinton was. But somewhere along the line, he became enamored with a different approach, which many people talk of as managed care or managed competition, as it was called, and to fundamentally change the structure of the system. And that not only was he going to change the structure of where we got our health care, but he was going to impose on the system very tight budgets that would affect not only people, but all the institutions, all the hospitals, all the doctors. And what you found was Altman's rule in spades. Every group said, gee, you know, I think healthcare reform is good, but I don't like this one. And when he finally unveiled his bill and then tried to get it passed, he didn't have very many friends. Even groups that would have been supportive. And by that time, I was long gone, because in that Little Rock meeting that you talk about, when the president-elect was moving up from Arkansas, we went and made our case for why the incremental approach, and we were destroyed by the forces that said, oh no, we can do this, we can cover everybody, we can provide extra benefits, and it's not going to cost anything. Why? Because we're going to rearrange the dollars. One of the statements that is said so often and is technically true but political dynamite is that there's enough money in our existing system to do everything we want. We just have to get rid of turn it around and change it and move it around. Well, it turns out moving it around means some people are going to get less while others get more. And the people that are going to get less are going to really fight.
So this walkthrough, which doesn't do justice to the book, helps us understand kind of the political context. But by the time we come to the 1970s, what we have in what's wrong with our system is, despite a lot of the good things about it, is that we have a problem with access. So some part of the population is not being covered. But as we've done all this incremental reform, costs have gotten out of control. And that's really the dilemma for our political leaders, including those who are excluded, but at the same time recognizing that health care cost-wise is out of control unless something is done.
So you're right, but let's understand how different groups look at costs. So if you're a Washington legislator, you're preoccupied with the part of the costs that are spent by government. So what happened was we passed Medicare in 1965, and even though there were several, very many smart people who said that once we're going to cover all these people, the healthcare spending for this group is going to grow by leaps and bounds, any estimate of how much it was going to grow turned out to be small compared to what happened. So within 4 years, from 1966 to 1970, 71, the amount of money spent by government under Medicare and Medicaid had just blown through everybody's estimates. So there was concern about that. But then you had the broader picture of other people, what you and I and people who were buying private insurance and employers were paying. And that also was growing. And so there were people that said, we need to be concerned about the total system. But here is, and so if you make the case that we need to gain control of the whole thing, but now we get into the issue, what does it mean to gain control of the whole thing? It means that you're going to squeeze and take money away from doctors and take money away from hospitals and take money away from pharmaceutical companies and equipment manufacturers and lawyers and consultants and so on. And what sounded like a great idea turns out to run roughshod among a lot of people's lives. And so it's much easier to cover people than it is to control costs. Mm-hmm. Controlling costs is a much more difficult than, as you know, and as you can see in the book, we have never done it. We've never controlled costs. And as we articulate in the book, in 1971, when Nixon imposed wage and price controls and asked me to be the person responsible for controlling, we were spending $75 billion, and it amounted to 7.5% of our GDP for healthcare. And we were told we could not afford that, and that if we spent more than 8%, who knows what would happen. Here we are today, we're spending $2.7 trillion. Mm-hmm. It now has gone from 7.5% of our GDP to 17.5% mm-hmm. of our GDP, and the language is the same. Mm-hmm. Somehow, we have managed to survive. Now, the net result is that we have a lot of problems as a result of that, but we're facing the same problems today as we faced in 1971.
Mm-hmm. And you know, some of the statistics in the book, we spend 2 times as much as other industrial countries, but 46 million are uninsured, and health outcomes, you say, were ranked 37th in the world. 1/7 of the entire economy, over 27% of annual medical expenditures are consumed in the last year of life. So it's a very complex bag of policy choices which can lead you to hurt one group while you're helping another.
Well, that's right. You're not going to... People talk about controlling health costs like it's a free good. That is all this waste and inefficiency and fraud, and that you can wave a magic wand and get rid of it, and no one will feel the pain. Well, of course, that's not true. Healthcare cost is healthcare spending. Spending affects people's income. And not only that, affects the care that they get. So as we debated today, people say, well, why don't we do what other, how could other countries do it? Why? And they get somewhat better results. And I use the analogy, I said, it's much easier to walk up a ladder than it is to walk back down a ladder. Have you ever tried to walk, climb off a roof and climb back down a ladder? I did. I was petrified. I couldn't get back on that ladder. It is, many of these countries took control of their spending when spending was not a big issue, and they never had to walk back down the ladder. They just grew more slowly. We don't control spending, and now we're talking about walking back down the ladder, much harder. The other thing that's, well, there are two other things about healthcare spending. One, the way other countries work, there's one spigot. All the money flows from government. So if you gain control of that spigot, you gain control of the spending. We have all these other spigots. So when one is constrained, like government, private spending goes up, and so on. We have all these different spigots. So that's the first thing that makes it harder. The second thing that makes it harder, healthcare in America is big business. Healthcare in other countries is a social service. Mm-hmm. Much harder to gain control over a business that is intertwined in every community.
Now, one of the positions that you held for a number of years was head of the Congressional Commission that looked at Medicare costs mm-hmm. and tried to figure out ways to define treatment and the resulting costs so that costs could be contained. What did you learn from that exercise?
Well, it reinforced my view how complicated healthcare is. Now, what you're talking about is in early when Medicare was passed, it was not viewed positively by everybody. The doctors were very concerned and were threatening to not provide care. There were concerns on the part of people who believed government was too big. So the Medicare program wanted to appease these forces and not, even though it was a major change, Medicare was probably the biggest, most radical change in healthcare that we've ever done, more than our current law. So the people who were responsible for implementing Medicare said, okay, we will pay hospitals the same way that Blue Cross pays you. And that is based on your costs. You tell us your costs, and we will pay our share. Sounds like a good idea. Well, it turns out, if somebody is going to pay your costs, what's stopping you from increasing your costs? They had no way of doing that. Blue Cross really had been created by the hospital industry, so they weren't really controlling costs. And so all of a sudden, Medicare found itself on a runaway train, which they were supplying the fuel for. And this takes us right through the 70s. In the early 1980s, Ronald Reagan becomes president. And he wants to, and his advisors, want to do away with this cost-based reimbursement. And they build upon a concept that had been growing, that what you should do is pay the hospitals a fixed amount for every patient, and that they should determine that amount by seeing how sick they are. And then they should put each patient into a category, which became known as diagnostic-related groups. You looked at the diagnosis of the patient, and that based on that, you paid. Well, this was a radical, radical change. No country had ever done that. No insurance company had ever done that. It was amazing that it was passed. So the Congress said, you know, we're not quite sure we know what we're doing. I mean, they didn't say it that way, but they meant that. So they formed an independent outside commission to oversee the system and to make recommendations to the Congress on changes. And it became known as the Prospective Payment Assessment Commission. And it was supposed to be bipartisan. And at that point, both the Democrats and the Republicans felt I was a person to be respected. Things do change. Mm-hmm. and so they appointed me as the first chairman of this group. And it was a very complicated. We had never done this before. It was incremental, but pretty radical incremental. And so our job was to make it work. And you know what? It did. Mm-hmm. And it's still in business today. So here it is 30 years later. Now, it's been changed a lot, but it's still the same basic concept.
A secondary Altman rule is you can't do access and cost containment at the same time.
That's right.
Why is that?
But as I said, access gets you a lot of support. People generally believe that everyone should have health insurance. Not everybody. But most surveys that I've seen over the last 20 years, 85% of Americans believe that in some form of universal coverage, that it's a responsibility of government to, in some sense, either make available or help support in healthcare for people that need it. But when it comes to cost containment, we go back to this issue. That means that you're going to be taking things away from people. And sure, it is true that in order to cover people, if you're not going to do cost containment, you're going to have to come up with the money. And that means that either we are going to have to pay higher taxes or in some case higher fees. And that's not the easiest thing to do. But it's much easier to do that than to literally go in to the pockets of doctors and hospitals and pharmaceutical companies, take the money out and then provide universal coverage. So while it makes all kind of theoretical sense to combine them, and everyone said, oh, you got to do them all together, and that's what Clinton tried to do, and that's what some people wanted Obama to do, it turns out to be politically, committed suicide.
You think Obama got it right. In other words, that implicitly the book hadn't been written yet, but in a way the way he handled the whole healthcare reform issue really follows implicitly a lot of what you're saying about the history, the political culture, and what leadership is required.
That's right. I mean, He's a smart guy, mm-hmm. and I was an advisor to him during the campaign, but not the only one, and not a major advisor. And he and his advisors, with help from people like me, said, "Look at the lessons we learned from the Clinton debacle. Don't try to do too much. Don't try to radically change the system. Leave cost containment for another day. You can begin the process." And the law does that. But don't offend the groups that you're going to need to help support this. And he understood that. And so did the Democratic leadership, including Hillary Clinton, who, after all, was the architect or the behind the architect for a lot of the Clinton health reform. She had learned her lesson. And so this time around, all of the major candidates of the Democratic Party adopted the idea of incrementally refining and changing our system.
And it's a tribute to Obama's political leadership that he achieved what he did, you're saying in the book. So that at the first instance, one might say, oh, he held back. He wasn't leading the process. He turned too much over to Congress, but by your argument, he really understood what the politics of this is about, putting aside whatever theory might say is the ideal way to fix the system.
Although there are many political scientists in particular who argued that the reason why the Clinton plan failed was that the architects of the Clinton plan wrote the plan out in great detail and didn't give Congress force Congress to have to live with a completed plan rather than letting Congress write the bill. So when Obama and they... Now, I don't happen to believe that. I believe the Clinton plan was killed because it tried to do too much. And I don't care if it had been written in the Congress or there. I think the issue was not process, but was substantive. But Obama and his advisors believed in the process. And they sent to the Congress only concepts. And they let the Congress work through it. Now, it worked, but I don't believe that was why it passed. I believe it passed because it was in its concepts and was the right. And as you pointed out, by him sending it to the Congress and then the Congress taking almost a year to work through it, he almost blew it. So I personally don't give as much credit to that part of the Obama plan that he let the Congress write it. But I give him a lot of credit for the substance of what was in the plan and the Democratic leadership.
It's very interesting because from an economist's point of view, and somebody who knows all of the technical issues, it's very clear once you read a book like yours why you need a mandate to because of the whole problem of sick people need the insurance, but healthy people don't, and so the system, the insurance system, creates a moral hazard, basically. But what's fascinating about this whole area is the politics can't digest that, basically, that the opposition, it's not just the particular interest that we've been talking about, but people get very emotional, you know, about that. And so it suddenly is socialism or almost a communist takeover by having a mandate.
Well, that's true. And, you know, as we talk about in the book, Obama himself was totally opposed to the individual mandate during the election. If you remember the debate he had with Hillary Clinton, she had an individual mandate in her proposal, and he didn't. Now, the whole concept of the individual mandate was originally put forth and more aggressively put forth by the Republicans, not the Democrats. And the reason is clear. Who are you forcing to buy this insurance? You're not forcing rich people to buy this insurance. They already have it. Or if they want it, they can buy it. What you're requiring are people who are above the cutoff point for subsidies or getting just little subsidies, who are not among the richest people, and saying to them, you have to buy health insurance. And that health insurance is expensive. So that is an issue. So Obama himself, during the campaign, did not support the mandate. But as you pointed out, once he became president, and he dealt with the Congress and with a lot of other advisors, even though people like me and other of his advisors kept telling him he needed the mandate in his own plan, he didn't do it. But once maybe we wore him down, because by the time he became president, he easily agreed to the mandate. And as you pointed out, the mandate is not a popular idea. It instinctively bothers people that the government is going to force people to buy insurance. But after all, the government forces people to do a lot of things. You know, we have to make sure that our houses are built. I mean, here we are in Berkeley, and look at all the mandates you have in terms of how you build houses and make sure that they withstand, an earthquake. We have all kind of mandates in terms of going to school and having vaccinations for your children before you go. We have mandates about wearing seatbelts. We have mandates all over the place. And, you know, it's that balance. I understand too much, having government totally control your life is too much. But having a jungle where you have no mandates is also terrible. You know, I tell people who are against all these mandates, I said, do you like football? Oh, yeah, yeah. Do you think football has too much government? What are you talking about? Well, football says that you can tackle a person, but you can't put your hands in their eyes and gouge out their eyeballs. You can't punch them in the face. You can't hit them in certain ways. So there's all these rules. Now, and yet they try to make the game flow. Well, it's the same thing with, we have to find the balance. And the individual mandate says, you have a responsibility. Yes, you will pay more as a young person than you really need to. But in so doing, when you get sick and you get older, you will have health care. And it's a trade-off.
In the end, the Obama plan, and we can't cover everything in an hour, but in the end, the Obama plan doesn't control costs, but it provides for models of experimentation to actually explore avenues that might lead to cost control. Drawing on your experience, where do you think the country will find the cost savings and cost controls that ultimately we're going to have to discover?
Well, as I said, controlling costs is hard. I'm from now the state of Massachusetts, and we were the only state that passed universal coverage, thanks to a large extent to Governor Romney, by the way.
But we shouldn't say that publicly. Yeah, go ahead. He may deny it, but please go
Well,
ahead.
He won't. He can't deny it. Yeah, he can't deny it. I mean, he was responsible. And but we have it. And now we, as a result, our legislators and our governor, for the we're the only state that is really grappling with not only what the state pays, but the total amount of money that goes for health care. And assuming that the individual mandate will be ruled as constitutional, we'll have to see, other states are going to have to deal with the same thing. Now, you know, we get back to this issue. Yes, there is a lot of inefficiencies and waste in our system. And we have to figure out ways to get at it. We'll never get at all of it. And it's silly to even talk like we can. However, we can do better. And these design changes that are in the law to restructure the way care is delivered is an attempt to put in place examples of how this country can change the structure of the delivery of care without totally blowing it up and moving it all around and get at getting these inefficiencies out. And most people have no idea that the healthcare law is really two very different pieces. The first part deals with coverage and who pays for it and all that kind of stuff. But the second part deals with all these examples of new ways of providing care. And the hope is, even if a lot of this first stuff is either ruled unconstitutional or is the money isn't there to pay for it, the second part will prevail and be preserved.
One final question. What advice would you give to students who are preparing for the future and have in mind being involved in policy making, policy analysis with regard to healthcare issues?
Well, obviously, as a professor, you want to believe that having them understand the issues and forces that affect the healthcare system is important. Because after all, that's what we do. But realistically, I think one should appreciate serendipity and be flexible. The world does not move in a tidy way. I could never have predicted how my career was going to go. I was well prepared with a good education. But I was willing to take risks. There were many points in my career where I went against the best advice of my advisors. I was willing to go to Washington before my dissertation was through and then do it. I was willing to break away from a tenured appointment. So there are a lot of, you know, if you're not going to take risk in terms of adjusting to how the life is given you, then your chances are you're not going to be successful.
Well, thank you, Professor Altman. Let me show your book again without blocking you there. And thank you very much for the book and for sharing your insights with us about this very difficult field.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity. It's a pleasure to be back on the Berkeley campus.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.